You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. In 1977, an expansion year with Seattle and Toronto joining the American League and the first season of free agency in baseball, the Chicago White Sox, who had finished last in 1976, put together a colorful and exciting team that grabbed first place and captured the attention of the city of Chicago like few teams in franchise history. Under the leadership of owner Bill Veeck, the season became a year-long festival with nightly surprises and a level of interaction between the fans and team that seldom had been seen, especially on the south side of Chicago. Although the team faded in the stretch and ultimately finished in third place, it remains to this day one of the most beloved teams in Sox franchise history. Our guest was one of the fans who fell in love with that team that came to be known as the Southside Hitmen. He spent two-plus decades with Stats, Inc. As we commemorate the 40th anniversary of the Southside Hitmen, we welcome to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball, Dom Zeminda. Don, great to have you with me. Thank you so much. The summer of 1977, what a glorious time to live in Chicago. Both the Cubs and the White Sox led their respective divisions, and there were dreams of an intercity World Series. What a magical time to be a baseball fan in Chicago.
Yeah, it sure was. A lot of people forget that the Cubs got off to a great start in 77 as well. That was one of the years when Bruce Sutter was in his prime, and he got off to a tremendous start, and the Cubs were actually contending well into June. Then they kind of faded apart, but the White Sox really stuck to contention really through well into August, and it was a tremendously exciting season on the South Side. I was there for most of it.
And they had finished last in 1976, so there could not have been any possible expectations.
Well, absolutely. That was one of the reasons why it was so special for us, because you remember in 1975, the White Sox had almost moved to Seattle. The team was close to bankruptcy. They couldn't find a local ownership group in Chicago. And they were all set to have the American League sell the team to a Seattle group. And then Bill Veeck stepped in at the last minute, and in fact, there was a lot of opposition to him coming back into the American League. So he came in, started very badly in 1976. So what happened in 77 was just a total surprise to everybody.
You brought your camera to Comiskey Park every night, and you eventually put together a photographic story of the team, its fans, its broadcasters, its opponents. You had sound bites from the games and historical data. What got you started?
Well, I had always been an amateur photographer, and particularly during that period in the 1970s, I had some good camera equipment. I used to routinely take my camera everywhere and take pictures. And with the 1977 White Sox, we started to know probably in June that this was going to be a special season. And back then, you know, unlike now in Major League Baseball, where in a lot of places the stands are filled every night, there were a lot of nights when there were pretty sparse crowds, especially early in the season. So I was able to kind of sneak up close to the action, get some good pictures. And then I kind of got rolling. And then once I got into a system, I started going well before the game started, was able to take pictures of the players in the dugout, get some good shots, and I got a good telephoto lens. And it just kind of took off from there. But I just got totally wrapped up in the excitement of the season, which was easy to do because the interaction between the players and the fans and Veeck's whole operation was just incredible.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I mentioned in the open about there were surprises almost on a nightly basis and that the level of interaction between the fans and the team was extraordinary and certainly nothing that we would ever imagine happening today.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, I mean, Veeck had all these crazy promotions. Some of them were kind of stupid, but he really had a way of getting the fans involved with what the players were doing, with what Harry Carey was doing. You remember Harry Carey singing Take Me Out in the Ballgame? Take Me Out to the Ballgame. That was something that Veeck had brought in late in 1976. And in 77, that became a regular feature of the White Sox games. The broadcasters were enormously important to the interaction between the fans and the team. Not only was Harry Carey there really at his best with the White Sox, but Jimmy Pearsall was his sidekick for the first time in 1977. And they were just crazy and fun, and everybody got into it.
Boy, and Pearsall would take on everybody, including Mary Frances Vec, the owner's wife, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, it got kind of out of hand after a while, but in 77, he was new, he was fresh, people loved him. The fans always loved Jimmy. I mean, he had some friction with players and management, but Jimmy was always loved by the fans, and so was Harry, of course. On top of that, you had Nancy Faust, fabulous stadium organist, was always clued into what was happening on the field. She brought in the Na-Na Hey-Hey song, which is kind of sarcastic, but it was a way for the fans to interact with what was happening on the field.
Right. She popularized the singing of Na-Na Hey-Hey, Kiss Him Goodbye, and that became one of the signatures of that season.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing that came in that season with this team was players taking curtain calls after home runs. This was something that was really brand new in baseball at that time. And I remember the Kansas City Royals in particular were incredibly incensed about this. You know, players, you know, showing up the opposition. The White Sox fans loved it. When somebody would hit a home run, we would always insist that the player came out for a curtain call. And then eventually the Royals just gave up and started doing it themselves. And then it really caught on throughout all of baseball. But this was something that was new and was brought in by this team and the fans in 1977.
But before the Royals started doing it themselves, was there not a fist fight between their catcher, Darryl Porter, and Bart Johnson, a pitcher on the White Sox?
Yeah, it got pretty nasty, you know, not only on the field, but in the press. I mean, Hal McCray just went crazy about this, and there was a lot of bitterness on the part of the Royals. And, you know, it really added to the heat and the excitement of that season.
Dom,
people forget in 1977 baseball was totally different. This doesn't have to do with the White Sox. Remember in 1977, the Royals Yankees playoff series, there was a fight between George Brett and Greg Nettles in game 5. Both players stayed in the game after that.
Right.
So there was a lot more heat, a lot more excitement, and a lot more tolerance on the part of the officials to let this kind of stuff happen.
Dom Zeminda is with us. He is an expert on the Southside Hitmen this year, celebrating their 40th anniversary, one of the most beloved teams in Chicago baseball history. We need to establish, so before we talk about the team and their incredible offense, we have to talk, Don, about the fact that this was against the backdrop of a franchise that was truly strapped for cash, which you spoke about a moment ago.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the free agency change came in shortly after Vec had bought the team. And he said later that if he had known that this was going to come in, that he would not have put together an ownership group to buy the team because he really knew that he was too financially strapped to compete with the richer owners in baseball. You know, nonetheless, he was there and he did the best that he could. He took advantage of the rules to an extent in 1977 by trading players who had talent and value for essentially for one-year free agents. The biggest names there were Richie Zisk and Oscar Gamble, who both had tremendous years for the White Sox, but that was their only year for the White Sox because that could not afford to pay them after that season.
Bill Vec and his wonderful general manager, Roland Heeman, thought that they could keep an underfinanced team competitive in the free agency era by fielding a team made up of young players and veterans playing for a lucrative contract, probably elsewhere. And that was a huge risk, but obviously it paid off, Don.
It certainly paid off that year. And, you know, they really came close to pulling the whole thing off. I mean, the team had a 6.5 game lead at the end of July. And, you know, it almost worked for the whole season. But, you know, whether they won the pennant or not, the difference between how the franchise was looked on at the end of 1976 and then at the end of 1977 was night and day. And it really reestablished the White Sox in Chicago to an extent and helped that franchise tremendously.
Speaking about big trades, taking a risk, they traded two really fine young pitchers, one of whom that would become a Hall of Famer, trading Goose Gossage and Terry Foster, right-handed and left-handed pitchers who had come up together, to Pittsburgh for Richie Zisk, who had 1 year remaining on his contract. They acquired Oscar Gamble, who also had 1 year remaining on his contract, and they signed third baseman Eric Soderholm as a free agent that year. And the team went on to hit 192 home runs, a record that lasted almost 20 years until 1996.
Yeah, and you have to remember, the White Sox were always known for being underpowered. I did a graphic for my Sabre talk in which I showed the average total of home runs per season by the White Sox from 1901 to 1976. They averaged 58 home runs a season.
Wow.
As a team. So they hit 192 home runs. That's unheard of for a franchise like that.
Richie Zisk had 30. Oscar Gamble led the team with 31. Eric Soderholm had 25. A young Chet Lemon had 19. Jim Spencer and Lamar Johnson each had 18. What a deep lineup.
Yeah, it really was. It was fun from top to bottom. Even the catchers, Brian Downing and Jim Essien, were contributors. Really, the whole lineup came through that season. And like I said, it was part of the thrill of the season was just that not only was it surprising that the team was good that year, but how they were good through power and hitting. Totally unlike most White Sox teams.
The team got shut out in April, and then this is just extraordinary. They did not get shut out again until September. Nobody does that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, especially for a White Sox team to go through a stretch like that. And again, you know, that was part of why this team caught the attention of the whole city and why it captivated the whole city of Chicago.
I need you to talk about the attire. No conversation of the 1977 White Sox would be complete without talking about these ridiculous collared blue and white jerseys that they wore that they also had worn the previous year. And when they ran, it looked like they were flying.
Well, exactly. Well, fortunately, in 1977, they did not wear the shorts. That was something that Beck had brought in 76 that they used in a couple games. The players hated that so much that they did not repeat it in 77. But those uniforms, you remember 1976 was the centennial of the National League. So they were celebrating a century of baseball. So a lot of teams had like pillbox type hats, and these collared uniforms were a kind of throwback to how teams dressed in the 19th century. For some reason, Beck decided to keep it after 1976. It kind of added to the aura of wackiness of the whole team.
But really, truly, the team owned Chicago, Don, not just because of their performance on the field, but because the fans were able to get close to the team.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that's really surprising, yeah, people think of Chicago as a Cub town, but in 1977, the White Sox outdrew the Cubs by over 200,000. That's how popular the team was that year. And I think the old ballpark added to the intimacy. It was a ballpark where you get a little bit closer to the action. If the stands were filled on a big night, the fans were kind of on top of the players. It was really a great place to see a baseball game.
Dom Zeminda is with us. He is an expert on the Southside Hitmen, celebrating their 40th anniversary of their extraordinary season in 1977. And back to Harry Carey for a second. Everybody, of course, remembers Harry with the Cubs, but he had been across town on the Southside with the Chicago White Sox. And what was really amazing was that at that time, they really weren't on a television station that was seen in many homes, had poor transmission. The production of the games was very poor, and it was very difficult to follow the team if you didn't go to the ballpark.
Yeah, that was really true. The White Sox throughout the 1950s and 60s had been on WGN along with the Cubs. They always felt that they were playing second fiddle to the Cubs, and probably for good reason. So in the late 1960s, the White Sox ownership went to UHF, which even in 1977 was reasonably new. You know, you had to have a contraption on the back of your TV to even get a UHF station. Reception, as you said, was often poor. So they handicapped themselves in that way, and they really handicapped Harry, but it didn't matter. He was so popular that it really added to the popularity of the team. Nothing stood in the way of Harry Caray being popular, promoting the team, and really adding to the interest that everybody had in the franchise.
For a new generation of people, we need to explain what UHF stations were, because at that time, channels 2 through 13 on your television were what were called VHS stations, and the production values were quite high, and they were the best of the bunch. Then you had your UHF stations that were lower power after Channel 13, and here the White Sox found themselves on Channel 44, and you needed, I guess, a magnifying glass to be able to enjoy the game.
Well, you remember the days of jiggling the aerial?
Yes, right.
That's really what you had to do.
Yeah. The White Sox were in first place in 1977 from July 1st through August 12th. But in that six-week period, Don, it must have been just magic.
It really was. There was a particular series at the end of the month against the Royals. It was Friday night, Saturday afternoon, and then a Sunday doubleheader back in the days when they still did doubleheaders. Stands were packed for the whole series. White Sox come from behind to win the Friday game. Everybody goes crazy. White Sox come from behind again on Saturday to win that game. Sunday, first game of the doubleheader, they come back again to win the game in extra innings before a crowd of over 50,000. And then between games of the doubleheader was Banner Day.
Wow.
With all the fans with their banners marching around the stadium. So, I mean, that whole series was insanely dramatic and interesting and exciting.
They wound up finishing third behind eventual winner Kansas City, which repeated their championship in the Western Division of the old American League West. They had won 102 games. Texas finished second, and the White Sox finished third at 90-72. What happened there that they faded? Did they just stop hitting?
Yeah, I mean, that was a bit of it. But the pitching staff was pretty strapped as well. I mean, one thing that I noticed was that during that season, they only had two relief pitchers who appeared in more than 30 games, which is something that would never happen in 2017, of course. But just that fact alone points up that it put a lot of strain on the starting staff. Those guys kind of wore out. The comfort behind victories, that's not something that is going to last forever. But the other factor that was involved that a lot of people forget was it's not only the White Sox cooled off a little, it was that the Royals got incredibly hot. I actually looked this up this morning. During one period from mid-August until late September, the Royals played 39 games and went 35-4.
Wow.
And who's going to compete with that?
Right. And then the season ends, and Zisk goes, and Gamble leaves, and the team is dismantled, basically. That had to be very sad.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I became a partial season ticket holder during that period. And just going to the games in 1978, after the first month of the season, you knew that there was not going to be a repeat of the miracle. And then you remember 1979, that was the year of Disco Demolition.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you came back 2 years later for Disco Demolition night with your records, your 45s.
Unfortunately, I missed that night. I'm not sure whether I would have wanted to be there or not because it got pretty crazy. But by that point in his ownership, the jig was kind of up for Vec. And he began looking for a new ownership group to buy the team because he knew that it was hopeless and he couldn't compete. Unfortunately for him, he made sure that he found an ownership group that would keep the team in Chicago.
And Vec said that the 77 club, Don, was even more satisfying to him than the 59 club, and that team went to the World Series.
You know, and I agree with him. Because I was, you know, 11 years old in 1959, but I went to some games that year, and it was a fun team. It was an exciting team. But it was speed pitching a defense, which, you know, God bless it, is not as interesting as a team that hits home runs. And also that 59 team, they won the pennant after contending for a number of years. The 77th season just came out of nowhere.
How often do you think back on 77?
You know, a lot. I actually ended up with over 300 pictures from that season. I am a collector of radio broadcasts, I've been able to acquire a few radio broadcasts of games from 1977. And it's really one of the highlights of my baseball fandom in my whole life.
And to know that it could never happen again.
No, nothing like this really could happen again.
Don, thanks so much for being with me. So that'll do it for Don Zeminda and myself on MLB.com. If you were on the move, thanks for the ride. And thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.